doing an unusual show today for us. Maybe it would be an unusual show for anybody. We're exploring a topic that's very sensitive in society. It's the topic of neonaticide. We are going to be talking to somebody that you may have seen in the news, but maybe not have gotten to know. I think this is the kind of story that people read about or hear about or see on television and have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to, but don't really attempt to understand it. Today, we're going to try to understand a little bit more about what this phenomenon is. To help us do it, in studio is Panna Krum, former inmate at York Correctional Institute in Niantic until quite recently, and the newest member of the Safe Haven Working Group. Also in the studio with me is Doug Hood, a former physician's assistant in neurology at Yale, pursuing a career investigating criminal injustice cases. Joining us in a little while, Michelle Oberman. She's a professor of law at Santa Clara University of Law and the co-author with Cheryl Meyer of When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison. We are going to tell you some of the story of Panna Krum. As I say, if you've been watching the news or reading the newspapers, maybe you think you know it already. But we're also going to talk about this phenomenon. It really maybe is not exactly what it appears or what your automatic reflux told you that it was. So first of all, I want to say hello to Panna Krum. Welcome to our studios.
Thank you for having me.
You were recently released from prison. And maybe, just tell us, how long were you at York Correctional?
I was at York for a little over 9.5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like 9 years. It's almost 10, right? 9 years?
Almost 10. Yeah. In January would have been 10.
And what day did you get out?
I got out September 30th, 2016.
Yeah. And Doug Hood, I've read this story several different ways, and I'm mildly confused about the terminology. It wasn't a pardon. It was more of a commutation, and it was based on clemency. I don't know. Can you tell us just the mechanics of how this works?
Yeah. She got out on a clemency, and they call it a commutation. Both of those mean a shortening of the sentence. It's a system devised outside the court system where her case is reviewed by a panel. It's a government-appointed panel, and they look at all aspects, including listening to the prosecutor, and they look at her file. She obviously had a stellar file, and decide whether they will grant a clemency. There's only been 4 granted in the last 30 years, so it's pretty rare.
I'm going to tell Panna's story in a second. It's a difficult story for her to tell, but I want to introduce you to the audience a little bit more, Panna. You're the daughter of Cambodian refugees?
Yes.
Your parents fled the regime of Pol Pot, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Yeah. And how long have they been in the country here?
They've been in the country for a little over 30 years now.
I think I read in one of the emails, I think it might have been from Wally Lam, not from Doug, that your father was he a ruby miner in Cambodia?
Yes.
Yeah. And also a kickboxer when he was young?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to quickly summarize the facts of the case. Panna became pregnant in 2006. She was 16 years old at the time. She hid her pregnancy from her family. She self-delivered her baby alone in her bathroom and committed neonaticide by drowning after the birth. She then put the baby's body in a closet. She was arrested, signed a confession, and pled guilty to a first-degree manslaughter. She was sentenced to 18 years at York Correctional Institute. As we just said, she served just under 10 years before receiving that act of clemency recently. Maybe you can say a little bit about what the clemency means to you, Panna, or at least how you feel as though you qualified for it. You had said at the time of sentencing that you were going to do a number of things while you were in prison. You were going to use your time in prison as productively and profitably for society as possible. So what did you do?
I participated in as many groups and programs that I could to help myself and help others to get the help that I needed and kind of guide others that were maybe going through the same situation in terms of having to be in prison. So I also got involved with in education courses. So I took college courses to keep myself busy. I stayed out of trouble. I considered every action before I made it because I knew I finally had to do the right thing. Once I entered York.
We should say that I think you completed – well, first of all, you had to complete a high school degree, right? You weren't quite there yet.
Right. I was a senior when I went into York. So I had to complete a few more credits to receive my high school diploma, and which I did. My high school in Danbury sent my diploma to me there.
And then after that, I think, 6 semesters through the Wesleyan prison education program?
Yes, 6 semesters.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about what it's like to be out, what kind of road you think you're going to walk. But maybe, Doug, before we do that, you can talk a little bit about why you pursued clemency. I think you got involved in this case in 2012.
Yeah, that's right. I realize we're kind of the odd couple here. We were working for the same thing on each side of the wall. I first heard about her case in, it was about 2012, 2013, when I was up at Hartford at a hearing, and a young lawyer went up, and she said, you know, the story of Ponochrome is one of sadness and shame, and I was intrigued with that, and I realized that she's at York, where I was volunteering, so I was able to make a connection with her there.
And one of the things that you started to do was to look at the history of neonaticide cases. These are cases where the baby dies really at the time of birth in the first 24 hours. It's defined legally a couple of different ways. And Connecticut really hadn't had a lot of prosecutions for this. What did you find?
Yeah, that's right. First I was struck by her sentence, 18 years. And so I was curious, is that lengthy or is it a lax sentence? And so I kind of looked to see what the other cases were, and there weren't any. So I went on kind of a journey around the state, digging up all the cases I could. I found 11 cases, but what I was particularly interested in were the teenage cases that were similar to hers, because this is a whole different profile. And I found a total of 6, including hers.
And tell us about the sentences for the other ones.
Well, the other ones, they were out of those other 5, two of them were never charged. One never, hers was suspended. She never went to prison. One got 7 months, and one got 18 months. And then Pontus stood out at 18 years.
Yeah, and we'll be talking more with Michelle Oberman about how that mirrors national statistics. There's even one study that our forensic psychologist did. She looked at 300 cases and couldn't find anybody who'd spent more than a night in prison. Here in Connecticut, our numbers are maybe even higher than what you'd find in other places. She was looking at, I think, both the U.S. and Britain in that study. But obviously, this is a much longer sentence. And Doug, you know, going back, I mean, you obviously weren't present at the time of trial, but I mean, is it clear to you why this was the case?
Well, it largely comes down to the prosecutor and the judge and, you know, your resources, mm-hmm. you know, whether you've got a lawyer with you when you're arrested. And she didn't. She had when the lawyer picked up her case, they had a signed confession.
Mm-hmm. Panna, I read a lot about neonaticide to get ready for this show. One of the patterns that we often see in these cases, particularly with very young mothers like you, is that this is a person often who has had no discipline problems in her life prior to this. She is almost the stereotypical good girl. It's not as though she's been, you know, causing a lot of trouble or anything like that. I get the feeling that that was kind of you as well, right?
Right.
I mean, if anybody had known you in high school as, you know, a sophomore or a junior, I'm guessing you would have been one of the least likely people in your high school in most people's eyes to wind up in prison.
Right.
Well, so what's that? I want to talk just a little bit about being in prison then, being kind of a stereotypical good girl, stay out of trouble kind of person. Suddenly you're in a prison population. It might be kind of a scary idea for a lot of people. What was it like for you? How did you get along with people?
When I went in, I was very intimidated. I didn't know what to expect from prison. I've never been exposed to prison in my life. I didn't even know York Correctional even existed. But when I went in, I was very scared, especially because I had a very high-profile case. So I, you know, assumed the worst. I assumed that the women would, you know, be extremely mean to me and call me names constantly. And, you know, initially it that was the case in the beginning. But I just knew that I, despite what others thought about me or the things that they said about me, I knew I just had to focus on myself. And grow. And like I said before, actually do the right thing this time. But prison itself was very daunting because, I mean, the thing that I always say that I, you know, missed out on the most was just being with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that I, you know, kind of I let them down by doing something so irresponsible and I essentially, you know, hurt others in the process. So being in that environment was just very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I try to take a full advantage of every opportunity that they offered to the women over there.
Because of the crime you were in for, I would imagine not everybody, even the prison population, was necessarily sympathetic to you. Did you have to be in protective custody at all while you were there?
I was in protective custody, yes, when I first went in for about 2 years. And then after that, I integrated into general population.
I also gather that you did make some close bonds, including with your cellmate. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I did. You know, it's very hard to just trust people in general. But, you know, I did form a very close bond with my cellmate. And she, you know, kind of guided me through my incarceration. She had been at York longer than I had. And she, you know, kind of taught me the ins and outs. And she was my coworker. She was my cellmate. We were in college classes together. So she was someone that I followed because I knew that, you know, she stayed out of trouble and she did what she had to do, you know, just to go home at the end of the day. So,
you know, there's a strange, twisted irony to this. In some ways, the history of neonaticide often involves young women who are in one way or another culturally isolated. What's one of the reasons it seems to happen? You also were alone and isolated at the time of your confession. You weren't supported anyway by an attorney the way a lot of young American kids probably would be. Then you went into prison, which was also a very isolating kind of experience. And now you're out. And I would imagine that's a little bit isolating, too, just in the sense of you've missed 10 years of cultural history. I would assume that when you went into prison, that you didn't ever have a smartphone because pretty much nobody did in 2006. I mean, that's just an example, right?
Right. I mean, coming out into the free world, as we would call it, it's very overwhelming. I mean, I'm extremely grateful and extremely thankful to finally be home, but there are a lot of things that I have to learn, and you know, I do feel left out sometimes because I don't know, you know, what anything is. And it's been less than a week since I've been out, so I'm still just trying to take it one day at a time. Technology itself is extremely advanced, and that even can be a little overwhelming because I don't even know where to start with, like, smartphones or
Facebook, Twitter, stuff like that.
Right. So anytime someone says something about, Facebook, Twitter, anything that has to do with social media, I have no idea what anyone's talking about because we didn't have that inside the prison.
Right. And I understand even, like, the other day your family was laughing at a joke that was a cultural reference.
It was. I guess it was about a video on the internet, and they just were all just laughing and kind of enjoying themselves. And I was kind of like sitting back, like I don't know what they're talking about. So, but I don't want to, you know, on a smaller scale, it seems kind of minute to say something like this. But like, I just don't want to be a burden sometimes and ask them like, what are you talking about? Because I don't want to ruin the moment or something, but so I'll just kind of like go along with it, and I'll usually like pull one of my cousins or someone to the side and ask them, what are you guys talking about, like what were you guys laughing about? But it's very hard right now, just trying to adjust to being free.
You were just 16 years old when you got pregnant. You were just turned 17 when the baby delivered. So your adult life basically has been spent in prison. I would assume that you probably feel more close or have more in common anyway with the women that you knew at your correctional facility than anybody else. That's who you were with for 10 years.
Right.
I don't know if you can elaborate on that at all. But I mean, I guess that means in some ways you're looking back at them and thinking, well, that's the last group of people who really is the only group of people who ever understood me as an adult young woman.
Right. And to me, I mean, honestly, again, when I went in, I had no idea what to expect. So I was expecting the stereotypical what you see in Hollywood movies or on TV. where prison's very sensationalized and it's very violent. But, you know, I met some of the most genuine women behind bars. And, you know, a lot of them did not judge me based on my crime. They, you know, they just took me for who I was and judged me based on how I treated other people. And I reciprocated the same to them as well. So, you know, and I always say it's ironic to say that it was very sad to leave prison because I had to leave many friends behind. Because, you know, from day one, when you go in, you're like, I just want to go home. But it was a catch 22 of sorts when the day that I left. So
tell us about Project Wrap.
Project Wrap is a group that is run by the facility itself, where high school students from all over Connecticut visit the prison. They take a tour of the facility, and then at the end of their visit, they sit down with a panel of about four inmates, and I was one of those inmates. We basically just tell our stories on what brought us to prison, and then they ask us questions. And the four of us each had different crimes, so that they can kind of get a feel of, you know, what kind of crimes or what types of crimes brought the women to York. And we were various ages, various ethnicities. So, you know, interacting with the high school students was, I think, my most passionate project that I was a part of.
Why do you think you were so passionate about it? What do you think that did?
I felt like I could connect with teenagers, you know, because I went in at 17, so that's all I knew. You know, people my age who never went to prison, so people that I knew from high school, they're all established. They all graduated college, have families, and they know who they are. Again, I went in at 17, so I kind of had to, my growth kind of was stunted. So I at times still felt like I was 17. And I felt like the only people that, you know, I could connect with were teenagers, even though, I mean, I could have been 21 or 22 at the time. And I just feel like, you know, I needed to get my message across to the younger audience who, you know, neonaticides, the demographic in which neonaticides occur. And I just needed to tell them and connect with them and let them know that, you know, there are options out there that I didn't know about, and that it can happen in anyone's community. It's not stereotyped to be in certain communities. It can happen anywhere. So,
and Doug, as somebody who's working a lot now in prison populations, I think, you know, she just used the word demographic, and I think this is a story of demographics in a lot of different ways. And I would assume you see that in this case and in other cases, that, like, just in terms of the sentence you get and where you wind up, Panna's sentence bears essentially no resemblance to anybody else in Connecticut any of a comparable age committing the same offense. So a lot of this has to do with the prosecutor you get. Steven Sedensky, the prosecutor in this case, seemed very eager for this to be a big sentence. It's the judge you get. But I think it's also maybe like who you are and the background you come from. As you look at other cases around that prison, Doug, and Panna's already nodding as I say that, I assume demography is destiny to a certain degree.
Yeah, I, you know, one can certainly attribute a lot to that. I, you know, the family is a Cambodian family. They're very simple people. They're actually nearly illiterate. This is one of the things that really drove me. They had no resources. And I should say, Panna is being kind of modest. One of the things that motivated me was that the moniker around York was, and this is even from the COs, that Panna is somebody that doesn't belong here. And so I think there's two cases in particular I'd just like to mention.
Sure.
There was a girl, and this mirrored Panna's case. She was a 17-year-old senior from Cheshire. She came from an upper-middle-class family. Her mom was a nurse. She hid her pregnancy. She threw the baby in the trash, and it was almost a perfect crime. They tracked it down because there was part of a credit card in it, and she would not have gone to prison, except at that time it was the famous prom mom case, and the lawyer said it was very difficult. He's going to have to tell this girl she was going to have to do time at York. Mm-hmm. She spent 7 months there. Mm-hmm. And in the other case that really quite an impact that I think may have, you know, helped her in her clemency was that there was a case at North Haven in 1988, and this girl was 19, an upper middle class family, and she hid her pregnancy and had the baby in the woods across the street and left it there and just checked on it every day, and it naturally died. And like a lot of these girls, she denied it, and they finally were able to verify that it was her baby, and she got her sentence was suspended. So she did community service, never went to prison. So in stark contrast to Panos. So our sample is so small, you can't, you want to say, well, in Danbury, did they think this was sort of a primitive family or something? But I don't know. You don't know what the subconscious, why she got this extraordinary sentence. Plus, she had a bond of $750,000. These other girls had no bond at all.
All right. We are talking about the case of Panacrom, but we're also talking about neo-infanticide in a much more general way, neonaticide, in a much more general way. And we will talk about more when we come back. Michelle Oberman, a professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law and the co-author with Cheryl Meyer of When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison, will be joining us to talk about this phenomenon itself and how it perhaps differs from other somewhat comparable offenses. So we're back. We'll be talking in just a second to Michelle Oberman, a professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law and the co-author with Cheryl Meyer of When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison. Joining me in studio right now is Panacrom, who was recently released from the York Correctional Institute in Niantic. She's the newest member of the Safe Haven Working Group. In the final segment of today's show, we're going to tell you about the Safe Haven program. It's a very, very important program. It's more people need to know about it. If, in fact, Pana had known about this, we probably would be telling a very different story, if any story at all, right now. Also with us in studio is Doug Hood, a former physician's assistant in neurology at Yale, now pursuing a career investigating criminal injustice cases. He was one of the primary advocates for Pana after she got her 18-year sentence. It was commuted, and she was released recently. She served a little bit less than 10 years of that 18 years, which is, as we've been saying, way out of proportion to the way these cases typically go. So, Doug, I'm going to start with you here just for a second. We've talked about this a little bit already, but I want to just kind of go through, and if Michelle joins us, I'm sure she'll want to elaborate. There is kind of a pattern here, right? There's if you hear about a neonaticide, you can fill in a lot of the blanks pretty easily and not be too wrong. The first thing you're going to find out probably is that there is some kind of isolation for these young girls. They're, they're either teenage or in their very, very early 20s, and there's some kind of isolation going on, right? There's some way in which maybe they don't have the full set of social connections.
That's true. Now, there is a dichotomy here between what I call and what the literature calls the premeditated cases and the cases that are not premeditated. So there are some in which the women are older. They've had pregnancies before, and this is not anything new to them. So there's a very concerted effort on their part to get rid of the baby. But what we're looking at is what you talked about. It involves Panna's type of demographic, and that is the young, single, this is a first pregnancy, isolated. Sometimes there's a cultural taboo about it, lonely, delivers on their own, denies the pregnancy. And yes, there's a clear pattern on this, and the psychologists have studied this, and the Commonwealth countries are way ahead of us on this matter.
And Panna, when you were pregnant, how was that for you? How did you feel when you were pregnant? In some of these cases, the young girls are almost in a state of denial that they are pregnant. That seems to crop up in some cases. How was that for you?
I completely agree with that. I was very much in denial. And the ways in which I dealt with it, I isolated myself because I felt very alone. And I knew that what I had done was very irresponsible. And I created this divide between myself and other people because I felt like I did something wrong, so I can't relate to other people because they can't empathize with me. They are, you know, they're on the right track. They're doing what they have to do, and I didn't. And that's one of the reasons why I couldn't ask for help, because I just felt like no one would understand me and that people would only criticize me. Because, I mean, teenage pregnancy alone is, you know, or at the time was known to have a very bad stigma on it. Just walking around the high school was very embarrassing, because I would get looks all the time and people would whisper all the time. And I just knew that they were just saying really bad things about me. So I just felt very guilty and felt very bad that I was, again, very irresponsible and didn't take care of myself. So.
Do you think that also, I mean, okay, there's whatever set of norms or stigmas might have existed within your high school, but I would assume also within the Cambodian culture, Cambodian refugee culture in America, I assume that's got its own set mm-hmm. of rules and ideas. I don't know if you can say anything about that.
Absolutely. You know, typically in our culture, you know, for the women at least, you know, we're expected not to engage in such activities before marriage. So again, I was caught in this cross between trying to fit in with the American culture, but yet also practice traditional culture at home. So if my friends were doing something, you know, I wanted to do it too, but it was very difficult for me to do because, you know, I grew up in a strict household. I grew up in a strict culture. And there were just so many expectations that we were expected to live up to. And to me, it was hard because I was a very curious teenager, rather. And it was very hard to, you know, even think about opening up to my family and saying, hey, you know, I'm stuck in this situation that I can't get out of, because I just, you know, thought that they would disown me. I thought that, you know, they would be extremely disappointed in me. I knew that I, you know, would let them down, and they'd be, you know, just devastated to hear that I engaged in something like that. So it was very hard for me.
You were carrying in two senses, right? You were carrying a child, and you were carrying a secret, and you were pretty much carrying it alone. Was there any support? I mean, were there people at your high school who at least knew and could semi-talk to you about this? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there were people, honestly, at my high school who, you know, approached me. So there were, you know, guidance counselors that approached me. And when they would ask me about it, you know, I denied it. I lied about it because I just felt like if I got myself into the situation, I had to deal with it on my own. Again, I did not think that anybody would be able to help me because I felt like I did something so terrible. And it was such a big issue that no one was going to be able to help me, and that I thought that if I admitted that I needed help to a staff member, that they would notify my parents because I was a minor. So I just told them what they wanted to hear, basically, and just tried to hide it from everyone, not just my family.
Doug Hood, as people in your life knew that you were working on this case, sometimes these cases are very hard for people to understand. It's maybe even a little unusual for a case like this one to excite sympathy on the part of somebody who's hearing about it, or empathy on the part of somebody who's hearing about it for the first time. I'm sure you've encountered that with people who find out you're working on a case like this one. What do you tell people? What do you tell people about why this isn't what they think it is?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This is a real issue because I look at it as sort of the three P's. You got the police report, the prosecutor, and the press. And so what is out there in the public forum is what the press prints, which is usually what the prosecutor says. And the prosecutor gets this from the police report, which is, I feel, very biased against them. So immediately you're trying to defuse where they think this girl murdered a baby. I have no sympathy for her. And it takes you a very long, exhausted explanation to get the real story out.
And the real story to you is what? I mean, when you tell people that story, I mean, I've been reading and thinking about this for just 24 hours. You've been living with this since 2012. What's the story that you tell people so that they'll understand it differently?
You know, I guess I just try to get them to understand, you know, what Pana was saying, that she was under this immense pressure, a young, naive girl. And not only did she not have her family support, The school knew about it and kind of let her down. The boyfriend threatened her. She had nowhere to turn, and she was really trapped and ended up with a crisis in the bathroom. I try to get them to understand that, and I think even as males, it's hard for us to even comprehend that.
One thing that I've been thinking to myself today, and actually we're going to add Michelle Oberman to the conversation. Maybe it'll come up as we're talking. As I said before, Michelle Oberman, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. She has written about this and studied this phenomenon extensively and is the co-author of When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison. Michelle Oberman, thanks for joining this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking a lot with Panacrom and with Doug Hood about the fact pattern or the set of behaviors that seem to repeat themselves over and over again in neonaticide. This is something you've really looked at a lot. And it really does seem as though it's a very different phenomenon than what we sometimes think of as infanticide. In other words, this thing that happens within the first few moments after birth, certainly the first 24 hours, it just seems like it's its own syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about that? If it is its own syndrome, what is it?
Well, the word syndrome is sort of a medical word, and I'm not a doctor, but I can tell you as a lawyer and a professor who studied this phenomena over the course of the past 20 years or so, that what you see is a very consistent pattern of girls who ignore or deny the fact that their pregnancy is progressing. And in fact, you've got other people in their lives who are, in one way or another, usually complicit in the ignoring or denying. So the girls are very isolated and are typically also socially immature, and so they do a lot of magical thinking, the kind of thing that teenagers do, where they think short term, like maybe it's going to go away, maybe it's not so real, maybe I'm not pregnant. And they don't do the long-term thinking that adults typically do, where they say, okay, I'm going to need a plan here because in a certain number of months I'm actually going to have a baby. And the fact that nobody else seems to notice that they're or to ask them about or to engage in planning around their pregnancy actually compounds that denial. One of the most bizarre, I think, and yet most consistent facts in these cases is that the girls have their babies thinking that they're going into the bathroom to have a bowel movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not kind of a thing that a person would plan, that any rational person would plan, at least. That's not how we have babies in this country. But the girls don't recognize that they're even in labor. They go into the bathroom, and their denial is so profound that they mistake the extreme pains of labor for a bowel movement. And to be fair, they're also usually in there for hours, and nobody notices or comes to their assistance as well. So the isolation continues from the time where they very first start to recognize and wonder about pregnancy all the way through the end of, and usually the quite traumatic and terrible end of having a baby unattended on a toilet.
Michelle, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Doug earlier. You've been working on these cases since the 1990s. I think it started when you were a public defender in Chicago, or when a public defender in Chicago, I guess, maybe asked you to become involved.
Yeah.
And I would imagine at first, most human beings, when they hear a story like this one, they don't have a lot of empathy. They don't think that this is something that they can even really wrap their minds around. You've been able to spend a lot of time with it. I'm sure you still encounter people like that. People hear about the book that you wrote or the work that you've done, and they say, what are you talking about? I mean, what do you say back?
So I feel like, first of all, Americans generally have a desire to blame individuals for really complicated social ills, and I completely get that. Like, when something complicated happens, we just want to find a person to pin it on and make it go away. And these crimes are uniquely horrific. I mean, it is the quintessential innocent victim. So I understand entirely that sense of, like, okay, these crimes have to be committed by monsters. It's just so easy, though, to peel back the layers and see that there's blood on more than one set of hands in these cases. I mean, there's the boyfriends who know who continue in many cases to actually have intimate relations and then say, well, they don't know or they didn't want to deal with it. There's the parents who touched rock-hard bellies but, you know, ignored the fact that the rock-hard belly is a sign of pregnancy, right? It's not, I mean, you know, there's nothing, there's no mistaking the belly of a person who's pregnant. There's the teachers, there's the neighbors, there's people who I wouldn't in any sense expect to be criminally liable. But at the same time, when we talk about why these crimes happen, you start to see like, oh, it's more complicated than just a girl who deliberately went out and got pregnant and elected to hide her pregnancy and elected to deliver the baby on a toilet, right? Once you run it through the sorts of deliberate actions we associate with first-degree murder, the story doesn't hold up. I mean, there's just none of the premeditation, the willfulness, the deliberation that accompanies your average first-degree murder. What you see instead are, you know, just, you know, situations that reasonable people wouldn't have engaged in, which is the hallmark of maybe an involuntary manslaughter, but not at all of a first-degree murder.
Right. So there's this classic landmark study in 1970, the psychiatrist Philip Resnick, who looked at neonaticides and compared them to mothers who kill older children, and they found they were sort of really, really different, that the mothers who kill older children are frequently psychotic, depressed, suicidal, exhibiting lots of signs of mental or psychiatric dysfunction, yeah. And they just you don't see that with the neonaticide cases. And let me just – I don't know. I was doing a lot of the reading in the anthropological and psychiatric research about this today. And one thing that rang very true to me, and actually, you know, when we even posted the fact that we were doing this show on Facebook, most people were overwhelmingly supportive about the fact that we were doing it. But there were some people who had some issues with it. One thing I said to them is, you should understand, first of all, that you are the product of something like this, that if you go back far enough in your human family tree, you get to a place where, in fact, this was a basic kind of human behavior, a kind of triage. 99% of our evolutionary history was spent in hunter-gatherer tribes that were in very exposed conditions, and that somewhere in our wiring, in our basic neurological wiring, there probably still is this tripwire that can be tricked. And when it was tricked back, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago, it was often a young mother who was alone, who was delivering a baby without help, who didn't have a male, a mate paired up with her to support her and secure resources. Mm-hmm. That this may be something. I mean, we don't know what it's like to be Panna. We don't know what it's like to have walked in our shoes. But this may be something that almost anybody's capable of doing if the right set of circumstances combine to activate that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And again, it's a supreme act of empathy to be able to place yourself in a situation where you could imagine being that isolated and that vulnerable. And I do think that that is an accurate depiction from the women with whom I've worked of how they see the world. And it's rightly or wrongly. I mean, for many of these girls, they believe that if they have the baby, they will be exiled from their families and really sent to the margins of their community. So even girls that are in families that would seem to be loving families believe that if their parents found out, A, that they had sex, and B, that they were pregnant out of wedlock, they would disown them. And, you know, later on in these cases, you often hear it from parents saying, oh, my gosh, we wouldn't have responded that way, and we would have welcomed our child and our grandchild into our lives. But what's important is not what they say in retrospect, but how the girls feel and what they do with those emotions, which is, again, very quintessentially adolescent. They panic, and they believe that they have to keep it a secret, and they believe that they will not be accepted and that they're actually at an impasse. They don't know what to do. The other thing that's actually important in these cases to understand exactly where the girls are is also the sense of their isolation leading them to choose not to have an abortion. So for most of these girls, they understand that they're living in a country in which if they have the money, they could get an abortion. But their isolation is such that they somehow feel like that baby is a beacon of hope. It's somebody who might actually love them and who they could love. And so their paralysis becomes both a, I don't want to have an abortion. I don't want to kill this possibility for hope and love. And yet I can't imagine having the baby because I don't have the support and I don't have a job and I don't have a place to live and my family will kick me out. And it's that just if you want to call it like an absolute storm of emotions that leads them to day after day not make a plan, not find a resource, not reach out, or really not have an adult in their lives or even a friend in their lives reach out to say, here, let's make a plan here. Let's figure out how we can make this work because this is real.
Well, we're in the next segment going to talk about, and Panna in particular wants to talk about a program that exists that can make a difference, that will make a difference for a lot of people in this situation. But Panna, as we're, you know, ending this conversation, I feel like we've been talking about you without talking with you. I know a lot of this probably rings true, that you were in many ways imprisoned in a story that you were telling yourself about what was going on and what would go on if things came out a certain way. And I assume now you know you're reunited with your family. It probably wasn't really the real story. It was the story you were telling yourself.
Absolutely. I had assumed that, you know, people were going to react one way when really, like Michelle said, they would have reacted another way. But again, it was just that fear and that desperation that, you know, again, nobody would understand me and people would just criticize me and they would hate me for what I did and they'd just be so mad and so disappointed that, you know, I just, again, assumed that they would not be supportive. And that was a story that I was telling myself because, you know, now almost 10 years later, I know that I could have went to someone and someone would have helped me, whether if it was in my family, at school, friends, or whomever, someone would have helped me.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're not going to have anywhere near as much time as I would like to talk about some of the resources that do exist, with means of support. But Panna wants to tell you about something called Safe Haven.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. You can hear all our shows on WNPR.org/Colin or on Stitcher, iTunes, or TuneIn. On tomorrow's show, our pop culture roundtable, The Nose. Now, back to Colin.
All right. I have to do a very special shout out because, in fact, when Doug Hood and Wally Lamb first approached us with this, I think that maybe the first email came into me. I started reading it, sharing it with Betsy Kaplan. I have three amazing producers here, Betsy Kaplan and Jonathan McNichol and Josh Nalea. And Wolfie, of course, is our technical producer. And they all have these incredible strong suits. But I knew right away I was going to be reading this email to Betsy. And I got about halfway through it. She said, we're doing this show. And you have to have a producer who can do this show, can make it work and talk to everybody and make them understand what kind of show we want it to be. So very lucky to have Betsy Kaplan here to do this. When I was getting ready for the show today, I ran into an old friend in the parking lot, Pam Sawyer, former state representative. I don't think I really understood until I knew that we were going to do this show what her involvement was. She's been involved with legislation to create something called Safe Haven. And, Panna, I'm going to let you kind of take over here and tell people what Safe Haven is. We should say first, it's something you did not know existed, though it did exist at the time.
Right. It was initiated into effect, I believe, in the year 2000. But the Safe Havens law would have saved my life and my baby's life because it's a law that protects both the mother and the child. So, you know, essentially what the law is if a mother, you know, decides that she can't keep her baby and she doesn't want to take the abortion route or the adoption route, she can drop, or anyone, the father of the baby, family member, could drop the baby off at any emergency room, at any Connecticut hospital, and remain completely anonymous. And you have the option to say, you know, I want to utilize the Safe Haven law, or you don't necessarily have to say anything at all, but, you know, again, you are protected. Your identity is protected. And that's what I was worried about because, you know, I was worried that it would get back to my friends or my family. And the Safe Havens law would have absolutely turned this story completely around. And as of yesterday, I attended my first meeting in Hartford at the Legislative Office Building with the Safe Havens Working Group. It was my first meeting, and I was very excited to just sit in and listen to, you know, all the ideas that we all kind of came up with to, you know, really raise awareness and spread the word about this law that no one knows about, especially the younger generation. Because I, you know, even through Project Wrap at York Correctional, I would ask the high school students, do you guys know what the Safe Havens Law is? And they had no idea what it was. And I just feel like the younger generation should know about it because, you know, obviously neonicides happened in the teenage community primarily. So I don't know. Again, I thought it was very, very important to kind of start that in prison and absolutely continue this while out of prison now.
Michelle Oberman, do you know how many states have anything like this?
The majority of states actually do have safe haven laws, and I think Pan is absolutely right that there's been almost no publicity around them. So this is sort of what I meant when I said earlier, boy, we really like to blame individuals for complicated social problems. And if we took seriously the promise of a safe haven law, we would recognize that without a lot of publicity to the generation of kids most likely to find themselves in this situation, the laws have very little chance of making a difference. And I think that actually if we implemented a really aggressive public awareness campaign around it, that even in the talking about the idea of a safe haven, you'd find girls in distress in situations like Panna's, feeling like maybe there'd be a trusted adult to whom they could confide their situation. In other words, it wouldn't get to the point that they found themselves in the bathroom with a baby trying to figure out where to take the baby and what to do. Right? So if you imagine, for example, a middle school health teacher talking about safe haven in the context of a sexual education class or even just a health class, then what you'd have is a person announcing herself as safe. And so a friend of a girl who's worried might go up and say, you know, I'm a little bit worried about my friend. I think that she might be pregnant. Or she's told me she's pregnant and nothing is going on. And all it would take is one person saying, I understand that this might be going on with you, and I'm here to help. Right? So even if it never got to the point of the baby being dropped on the steps of the hospital or the police station or the fire station or wherever the safe haven was, just the awareness of the need for a safe haven might prevent these cases.
Panna, we just have like 2 minutes left or so. I think probably people want to know what's out there for you now to make sure that you're okay. You've been through an adult life that isn't like anybody else's. Does Safe Haven provide you with the kinds of support you need now?
I think everybody that I'm kind of surrounded by now provides me the support because they, you know, obviously now I have nothing to hide, so they know, you know, where I was, and, you know, I'm pretty sure that they are aware of some of the challenges that I've had to face while in prison and then transitioning out. But, you know, I speak to various social workers, psychiatrists about my experience or, you know, before my incarceration and even during my incarceration and after my incarceration. So, and the prison also, before I left, provided me with reentry resources that I could utilize as well. So, you know, they researched different organizations or even clinics around that, you know, I could find that might provide me with more information about where I can get help from everything that has to do with clothing or even just mental health services. So to have someone to talk to. So, yeah.
What do you think you'll be doing in 5 years?
Definitely still working with the Safe Havens Working Group. But I think in 5 years, my goal is to, again, spread the word about this issue and just spark a conversation so that people don't necessarily have to sympathize with the moms who commit neonicide, but understand. Understand that this is a social issue that happens in society and we can't deny it. We have to do something about it that will help these young moms.
I want to thank everybody who participated in what I think was a remarkable conversation, certainly not like any I've ever had before. Panna Crom, former inmate at York Correctional Institute in Niantic and the newest member of the Safe Haven Working Group. It's her story that this show revolved around. Doug Hood, a former physician's assistant in neurology at Yale, now pursuing a career investigating criminal injustice cases. Michelle Oberman, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law and co-author with Cheryl Meyer of When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison. Also, thanks to Pam Sawyer, who's sitting out in the green room right now and showed up to support Panna, which I thought was a very lovely gesture as well. And so thanks also to my staff. We'll be back tomorrow with The Nose.